From Asia, with determination. From United Nations Radio, the second of three programs based on recordings made during a recent 3 months UN-sponsored tour of Asia by representatives of the broadcasting organizations of India, Indonesia, Japan, Malaya, Pakistan, and UN Radio itself. The first of these programs examined the Asian meaning of a now familiar phrase, the revolution of rising expectations, in terms of the mass demand for health, housing, education, employment. In short, for a standard of life that is now both technically and rationally possible. UN Radio now invites you to join the international group for the second phase, an examination of the economic response to these demands throughout the Asian region. We're calling it From Asia with Determination. We are in Japan as we step out of the plane at Haneda Airport, Tokyo, and inhale our first breath of unconditioned air, we're conscious of something we've encountered only once or twice during the tour, and then less intensely. It's a smell in the air, the smell of industry, heavy industry. Steel, the thunderous production of girders, sheets and tubes. Cars, trucks and tractors, produced with automation and manpower. Ships, locomotives, turbo generators, an industrial spectrum ranging from the giant tanker to the tiny transistor. As we move through the dense Tokyo traffic, or through landscapes in which rice fields and factories merge to blur the dividing line between town and country, we can't help contrasting the scene with so much that we've observed during the tour. This, with all its aesthetic faults and social problems, is development. This is the objective. But we resist this vaguely critical line of thought, because the contrast brings Asia's basic economic problem into sharp focus for us, both the problem and the response. The United Nations Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East is holding its 16th session in Bangkok. We are in the press seats in the Assembly Hall, listening to the delegates debate the Commission's report on the region's economic health in 1959. The delegate of the Philippines, Dr. Perfecto E. Laguio, is making a proposal.
I am privileged to present anew a proposal which on several occasions in the past I discussed not only before appropriate groups in my own country, but also before international conferences. I refer to the formation of an economic bloc among Southeast Asian countries, including initially the Philippines, Thailand, Malaya, and Vietnam, who have signified their intention to join such a bloc, and possibly Indonesia. Other Southeast Asian countries may later join the bloc.
Dr. Laguio is aware of the difficulty in forming such a bloc. And we, too, are told about it on many occasions. In Japan, for instance, we talk to a prominent businessman, Mr. Isaku Kikuchi, at the Osaka Chamber of Commerce. He's not opposed to the idea, but he finds the economic, social, and political situation in Asia very different from the situation which is forming the common market in Europe. He tells us that Japan's trade with other Asian countries is declining, while it is increasing with the West.
This is a very regrettable fact, because Japan is one of the Asian countries, and we have to have the normal and mutually satisfactory relations with Asian countries.
Mr. Kikuchi goes on to give some reasons why, at present, trade relations are unsatisfactory. One of them is this.
We try to buy as much as possible from these countries, but they offer very limited items. Most of the items we can buy from Asian countries are agricultural products, and the price is not necessarily reasonable.
Hearing this, we recall another part of Dr. Laguio's speech to the ECOFA delegates in Bangkok.
I realize the difficulties and limitations of economic groupings in this part of the world. I am aware, for instance, that unlike the European economic blocs, our economies are predominantly agricultural and largely dependent upon the unpredictable fluctuations of the world markets, and because of which our production incomes, as well as foreign exchange earnings, are so uncertain.
If this, then, is the basic difficulty, what is the prospect, not only for some form of economic integration within the region, but for generally healthier and wealthier national economies? Thailand's foreign minister, Mr. Thanat Komen, is chairman of the ECOFA conference, and we put this question to him, and he answers,
"For the time being, if we can hope to increase the exchanges between the manufacturing countries of Asia, I think we shall be doing a good start. That doesn't mean that the other countries of Asia should be reduced to the role of suppliers of raw material. That, of course, as far as my country is concerned, we are not willing to accept. On the contrary, we are pushing ahead as fast as we can in diversifying our economy. And as I said, the ultimate success of improving intra-regional trade between the countries of Asia lies in the fact that the countries in Asia will succeed in industrializing their economies and diversifying their economies."
Will succeed. We note the determination. But what of the techniques which use the strength of determination to bring about diversification, industrialization? In every country we visit, we hear of the same thing: planning. Planning necessarily adjusted to local needs and capacities, but still planning. In India, we talk to the Prime Minister, Mr. Jawaharlal Nehru.
Now, to industrialize with limited resources, we have to plan to use those limited resources to the best advantage, not leave it to chance or leave it to what might be called market economy.
In Pakistan, President Mohammed Ayub introduces his country's second five-year plan.
The emphasis in the plan is on expeditious agricultural and industrial development. It is a workmanlike plan, an active program which the country needs. It reflects our national aspiration for economic and social betterment, and it sets out the strategy of our battle to realize those aspirations. We must win this battle.
In Malaya, we hear the words of the Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman.
We are trying to carry out a very ambitious development plan. That development plan is concentrated mostly on development of the rural areas. The urban areas is developing very satisfactorily because all the capital seems to be invested here.
In Cambodia, Mr. Pierre Gutman, an economic statistician working there under the UN Technical Assistance Program, tells us,
"Here we have little statistics and we do not have too much information about the general economics of the country. So a plan here, in our opinion, means really that we shall try to organize public investment, that we shall try to amalgamate foreign aid with Cambodian efforts. 1960 is the first year. We are only starting now, and it's not before another 10 months that we'll see the beginning of the results."
We could, of course, spend more time like this in more countries. We could note all the variations on the theme of planned development, the differing points of emphasis, and the careful determination of project priorities. But instead, let's leave the ministerial offices, the boardrooms, and statistical bureau, and get out into the field to observe planning in action. We are in the main railway station in Karachi. We have tickets for a train with a romantic name, the Khyber Mail, leaving for the north at 9 p.m. For a while, we watch the moonlit landscape through the window. Irrigated fields of rice or oil seeds, citrus orchards, occasionally an uncultivated stretch where the desert is still in command. Then we sleep. At 5 a.m., we leave the train at Rorey Junction and drive across a dry plain of dull grey dust, fine as talcum powder, until we reach the River Indus. Here, at Kashmore, men, machines, donkeys and camels are engaged in a mighty project, the construction of the Gudu Barrage. We meet the superintending engineer, Mr. Asghar Ali Abidi.
Well, from the very beginning, the project has been conceived, designed, and constructed by Pakistani engineers. Even on the financial side, we have not utilized any foreign aid on this project, and all the financing has been done within the country.
We ask Mr. Abidi about the impact the work will have on the overall economy of Pakistan.
It is expected that on complete development of the Gudu Baraj area, we shall be producing an additional quantity of 500,000 tons of food grains over and above what we produce now. Also, the population of the Gudu Baraj tract at the present time is of the order of 1 million people. There are certain areas which are very sparsely populated for the simple reason that there is not enough water to irrigate the land. We expect that a large number of population would be adjusted in such areas from the more overcrowded parts of the country. This tract, which has been lagging behind in its general development, would soon be able to catch up with the modern world as soon as the barrage comes into operation.
An example of planned development of what economists like to call the infrastructure, the basic requirements of a country determined to catch up. Now let's move east to Malaya, where, as the Prime Minister told us, the emphasis is on rural development. We drive out from Kuala Lumpur, the road rising 2,000 feet through hills, where nature displays herself in her most uninhibited, extravagant mood. Where a cutting reveals the naked earth, it is a rich, deep claret in colour. After 60 miles, we reach the Bilut Valley. On the surrounding hills, a mist rises out of the jungle, as if beneath the green-blue blanket of trees, an old fire is smouldering. But the valley itself, or 6,000 acres of it, are clear. There is a village of neat new houses, and this is the Bilut Valley Land Development Scheme, one of several similar schemes in Malaya, and we talk to a man who has helped get a number of them started. He is Mr. Abdul Jalil bin Nuruddin, and we ask him first who the people are who move into these developments, what qualifications they must have.
The classification have six factors. They are poor and landless. They have got a big family to support. They are federal citizen. They are physically fit to undergo heavy work in the jungle. They are free of crime, and they are of legal age.
To talk about the Bilut Valley scheme in particular, how many people are you going to settle there, and what are they going to cultivate? How much land are they being given? In other words, could you sort of describe for us exactly what you're doing in this valley now?
We have got an area which is sufficient to provide land for cultivation to about 600 families. So each family will be given 10.25 acres of land, 7 acres where the settlers will plant rubber, another 3 acres for fruit cultivation, and the remaining 1/4 acre is for housing site.
Now, what about the financing of this?
When the settlers comes in, they are being provided with housing materials, planting materials, tools and implement, which goes into their own account. And whatever other expenses will all be paid by the corporation. And at the end of the 6-year period, the total amount advanced to each settler will be calculated, and they will have to pay 7% interest on the amount of loan given.
By these and many other means, we find governments throughout the region striving to keep the development of industry and agriculture properly balanced. And speaking of industry, we see in India a development that is, in many ways, an industrial echo of the Bilut Valley scheme. We're standing in a factory at the Okhla Industrial Estate on the outskirts of Delhi. This one happens to make lathes, but there are 35 other factories in the estate producing such things as amplifiers and radio equipment, brass and copperware, locks, steel doors and windows, nails, bicycle frames, razor blades, polythene bags, and office furniture. Within a year, 40 more factories will rise at Okhla, and Okhla is only one of 60 such estates scattered throughout India. They are complete working communities with canteens, employment exchanges, trademark registries, and medical services. But why have they been established? Outside, away from the noise, we put this question to Mr. S.N. Chatterjee, the manager of the Okhla estate.
This is for the benefit of the small-scale industrialists in the country who do not get proper facilities in the city, and they have been provided with a factory and machines on hire purchase, some working capital, and some loans from the State Bank of India, and against raw material and finished goods for manufacturing the items of manufacture, which is certified by the Director of Industries. They pay a very nominal rent, which is about 50% of the economic rent, calculated on the basis of construction and development.
As we leave the estate, we notice a sign over the entrance to one of the factories.
There is no end to improvement. Make it better.
And the words at once trigger a chain reaction of impressions, not just of polythene bags and razor blades, but of a whole industrial crescendo that is audible, admittedly at varying levels, throughout the entire region. We see Indian steel from Bhilai and Rourkela moving into the Visakhapatnam shipyard in Andhra Pradesh, into the production of machine tools at Bangalore, into the integral railway coach plant at Perambur, Madras.
So this is the main assembly shop in which we assemble the entire steel coach. Now all the two side walls, the roof.
We see two-ton teak logs from the forests of Burma turning into prefabricated houses at a sawmill in Rangoon. And an FAO timber expert from Australia, Mr. J.L. Briggs, tells us...
There are plans to modernise the present mill and also build another large mill, which will have a capacity of 150,000 tonnes per year.
We see a huge pontoon dredger at a tin mine in Malaya, digging its own lake as its buckets bite into the tin-bearing soil. And we hear the chairman of the mine, Mr. W.M. McLeod, say...
I believe that because Malaya, I think, is generally admitted as being the world's largest producer. It's just commonly regarded as the most efficient producer.
We see Cambodian workmen putting the finishing touches to a textile mill at Kompong Cham, which will produce 5 million metres of cotton cloth a year. We see so many things. The colleges of technology, the centres of pure and applied research, and the mood of the men and women in them. And they all add up to determination, to the conviction that, in the words of the sign at the Okhla estate,
there is no end to improvement. Make it better.
Much, indeed most, of this effort, and this is perhaps not always realized outside Asia, is made by the countries themselves, by their governments and people. As Prime Minister Nehru tells us during our talk with him in Delhi...
While we welcome help from outside, and I'm grateful that we get it, the fact remains that the outside help is only a small proportion of what we have to do. That is, ultimately, the burden falls on the people. The burden falls either in the shape of taxation or loans or savings of that kind. Because the progress of a country is determined by the amount of savings in that country invested for progress.
But here, we come up against one of the ironies of underdevelopment.
We don't have money. It's a fact that everyone knows.
The Minister for Industry in Thailand, Mr. Boon Charun Chai, states the problem quite simply. If people are poor, their savings, if any, are slight. And since nobody has ever succeeded in getting blood from a stone, the returns from taxation in such a situation are likely to be less than adequate for really effective investment. Hence the need for outside sources of money. The UN Special Fund, for example, with its fund for pre-investment surveys. Or the World Bank, with its loans for major public works. Or the International Finance Corporation, with its investments in private enterprise. Then, there are the efforts which all these countries are making, we find, to attract foreign capital to their shores. Let's listen to Mr. Charun Chai again.
We are encouraging foreigners to come in our country and invest their money in industries. The investors will be granted exemption of income tax from 2 to 5 years the machinery, the imported machinery, will be exempted from the custom duties. They have the right to export their profits and capital back to their own country. And besides that, they have the privilege of bringing in skilled technicians and experts, for example.
But the outside element in the development plans and processes is not confined to finance. As we travel through the region, we find plenty of evidence of other things, like Cambodia's new port of Sihanoukville on the Gulf of Thailand, built by France, or the 180-mile superhighway connecting it with the capital, Phnom Penh, built by the United States, or the splendid new technical school in Rangoon, built by the Soviet Union. These, in the jargon of such matters, are forms of bilateral aid. We also find evidence of the multilateral approach, through the Colombo Plan, or more universally, through the United Nations and its specialized agencies. And it's when the national and international efforts are combined in a project of truly grand dimensions, a project nobly conceived and capable ultimately of transforming the lives of millions, that we sense the real force and meaning of cooperation. And we get this sense exactly midway between Laos and Thailand.
We're standing in the bow of a motor launch on the Mekong River, just downstream from Vientiane. On our left, Thailand. On our right, Laos. Before this great river finally empties its waters into the South China Sea, it will also mark the border between Cambodia and Vietnam. At the moment, the water's low. It's the dry season. We pass vast sandbanks and rocks. Telltale swirls indicate other hidden obstacles. Even our old and experienced Lao pilot is sometimes tricked by overnight changes in the course of the channel. But fed by the monsoon rains, the water can rise 40 feet or more. This river can become a raging tyrant, breaking its banks and sometimes the hopes of the villagers living along them.
Now, however, this age-old pattern is about to change. Man is about to discipline the Mekong, to make it serve him. At the Bangkok headquarters of the United Nations Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East, we meet Mr. C. Hart Scharf, executive agent of the Mekong Development Project, and he gives us the background.
A number of years ago, the United Nations, through its Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East, began to think about possibilities of developing this river. And finally, in 1957, the four riparian countries who live on the lower basin, that's to say Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam, decided at the suggestion of the United Nations to form a committee which would endeavor to coordinate work looking toward the development of the river.
At present, this work is preliminary, for the Mekong is largely an unknown giant. Its course has never been accurately mapped. Its rate of flow has never been accurately measured. Its banks have never been accurately surveyed, nor has the geological structure of its bed. And the engineers can't get to work on it until they have all this information.
10 countries have to date agreed to give us some of the assistance that we need to collect the engineering data which is necessary to begin the planning. After we have the data, we will then go into the stage of planning some of the projects on the main river. Then we will have to arrange for the investment finance that will be necessary to build these projects, and then after that we will build them.
The 10 are Australia, Canada, China, France, India, Iran, Japan, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Their help comes in many forms: money, survey boats, cement, petroleum products, rain gauges, technicians. And while we're in Laos, we're able to observe what some of them are doing. The Canadians, for example. They are mapping the river by aerial photography. And in Vientiane, we talk to the project manager, Mr. Robert Brocklebank.
The quantities of work involved are roughly 15,000 kilometers of aerial photography. The ground control surveys consist of some 9,500 kilometers, and the mapping work itself consists of some 50,000 square kilometers of terrain to be mapped.
Field parties conducting the survey are stationed at various points along the river. Contact with them is maintained by amphibious aircraft and radio.
Canadian Echo, Canadian Echo, Canadian Echo, this is Canadian Vientiane calling and standing by.
But what of the future? What happens when all the preliminary work is done and the engineers can move in? Back in Bangkok, Mr. Hart Schaff sketches the prospect.
Right now, we're thinking, looking over, say, the next 15 years, at three dams on the main river, quite a considerable amount of navigation improvement on the main river, which includes improving the channel, marking the channel, developing for some stretches of the river some new type of watercraft, which we think will make the stretches on the river navigable, which are not now navigable. Then the development within, probably within the next 5 or 6 years, four dams on four tributaries. Now, those are smaller dams, but each one of them has a multi-purpose effect, and each one of them is pretty considerable. For example, in Cambodia, the dam there that we envisage will double the present total electric generating capacity in Cambodia, so it's quite a good deal.
In a political sense, the River Mekong is the dividing line between the four riparian states. But in a broader sense, it is not. While we're in Vientiane, talking with Mr. Nui Abe, Vice President of the Council of Ministers in Laos, he makes a remark which we all note. The Mekong, he says, is not a border, it is a bridge. This, we realize, is not just a phrase. This river has always been the medium of cultural and commercial exchange in this part of Asia. Now, with modern technology and practical cooperation, it will become a bigger and better bridge than it ever was in the past. As the Foreign Minister of Thailand, Mr. Thanat Komen, says,
I think this is the kind of project that can attract the attention and catch the imagination of the peoples of Asia, as well as the peoples outside the area, the peoples of the whole world. Well, I think if we can give more attention, more concentration of our efforts on such projects, I think the development of the countries in Asia will reach the ultimate goal that we all want to attain, namely the improvement of the economic and social conditions of our countries and peoples.
Crystal gazing is not part of our brief on this tour, but after seeing all these things and talking to all these people, we're sorely tempted to do a little. Is it going too far, we wonder, to see in projects like the Mekong and in other truly international schemes like the ECAFE plan for a Pan-Asia highway linking Ankara with Saigon, to see in these the solution of the problems at present preventing the countries of Asia from forming the sort of economic union visualized by Dr. Lagio of the Philippines? Perhaps it is, if we only see these in the crystal. But add them to all the other efforts, both national and international, that are in sum the economic response to the revolution of rising expectations, and we can see that the ground for the future well-being of the world's most populous region is being very well prepared. And we'll risk one final prophecy. Success will crown these efforts, because the people making them are determined to succeed. From Asia with Determination was the second of three programs reporting a continent in motion. Based on recordings made during a three-month UN-sponsored tour of Asia, it was written and narrated by Ken Pittendry of United Nations Radio. The third program, From Asia with Courage, will review the social response to the new demands for a better life. This is United Nations Radio.